Joining me now on this edition of Our Town is Terry Greer. She is running for the District 9th seat of State House Representatives. How are you?
Hi, George. Thank you for including me on today's show.
Well, we're glad to have you. And since I have not had a chance to talk to you before, tell me a little bit about yourself. Introduce yourself to our listening audience and give us kind of a background of Terry Greer.
Well, I'm Terry Greer. I'm running for House District 9, and I want to be the state legislator for the citizens who live in the Coos Bay area, go up the coast through Douglas County, Reedsport, Winchester Bay, continue up into Lane County, and that goes clear past Triangle Lake, almost to Veneta. And then we just barely slip in and grab Yahats in Lincoln County. I decided to run basically 2 years ago when I was watching the short session and was really disgusted about what I was seeing. A combination of emergency clauses placed on almost every single piece of legislation. You may remember that the short session was set up so that they could deal with emergencies that came up in the biennium. So the odd years were to build the budget, to take care of major pieces of legislation, and the even years were a 35-day session specifically to do cleanup. That's not what's happening. We're having major pieces of legislation shoved through. During that time, we had the increase in minimum wage, mandatory paid leave, among other things. And as I saw that, I was very concerned, especially concerned about our small business community. My background is in public policy. I've worked in public policy for almost 25 years. I worked in a state legislature, and specifically I was lead staff on economic development, international trade, tourism, commerce. I also did a lot of rural health care work. I worked for a governor, and I spent 8 years in Washington, D.C., half of that time on the Hill working for a rural congressman. And so I have a lot of public policy experience, specifically as it relates to business and the economy, and I was really concerned about what I was seeing.
What is it about the short sessions then that allows stuff like that to happen? Is it that not everybody shows up to there, so there's fewer people to vote? Or what allows those things to happen during that period of time?
Lack of discipline on the part of the leadership. You know, the citizens were very clear what they wanted to have done, but it basically takes the governor and the leadership in the House and the Senate to set those rules and to stand by them. So you have a situation where in a long session, you could have a couple thousand pieces of legislation introduced and about 1,000 go all the way through the process. In 30 days or 35 days, you have, you know, 500 pieces and half of that go all the way through the process. That's a significant amount of legislation to be pushed through.
That's a lot of reading to be done that probably isn't getting done during those periods of time, maybe.
I would argue that. I would also argue that not just the reading and learning about the issue, but giving the public enough time to chime in on the issue. So those people who are in the know, the lobby who's there, and that's their full-time job, they're there to chime in on the issue. But Joe Citizen basically is being taken out of the process.
So I will say before we go any further, we did ask Katie McCune to be with us today. She could not be here, so I just want to tell everybody that, you know, that was the plan, was to have both of you talking today. So I'm going to give you some time to kind of point out some differences between or how you stand out on your own different than maybe what is currently being done in the State House.
I think what's most important is the word representative means that you're going and you're taking the voice of the people to Salem. What I'm seeing is that the people are speaking one direction along the coast, and our sitting legislator is choosing to go another direction. and that her influence has been very closely tied to the leadership. In fact, she was a member of the leadership. She served as the majority whip. As the majority whip, that actually, my first job was working for a majority whip. And the responsibility is to do just what the job says, whip people in shape to make sure that they support the majority program and or the governor's program. Kati sold herself as an independent voice. However, her voting record is 98.6% of the time with the Portland folks. That's not an independent voice. It is independent of what her constituents want, but not independent taking the voice and being able to stand up to leadership. A couple of prime examples, you know, Kati was a primary sponsor on legislation that would allow illegal immigrants to have driver's cards. The citizens very quickly moved to repeal that language after it was signed by Governor Kitzhaber. And in fact, in this entire state, 66% of the citizens voted to repeal that language. Only a small portion of Multnomah County voted to not repeal it. In addition to that, along our coastal area, it was over 80%. That's her constituency speaking and saying, we don't want illegal immigrants to have the rights of citizens. This last short session, when you're only supposed to deal with emergencies, that language was slipped into a piece of legislation that Kati supported. And come January, some illegal immigrants will be able to get driver's cards for 8 years.
Let's talk about some of the popular issues that are going on right now. One of the things, actually the Senate bill that passed this year, 1051, dealing with affordable housing, accessory dwelling units, and things like that for communities of certain sizes. There's a big need and a big push to get and find affordable housing so that workers can have, you know, jobs that support tourism, mm-hmm. especially in areas like this, coastal areas.
Yep.
Where do you stand on that, and how would you like to see that move forward?
I think we need to take a step back and look at what has transpired over the last 15 to 20 years. There was a movement by a certain segment of the population that was concerned about urban sprawl and at the same time concerned about population growth. In order to curtail that, across our country, we establish urban growth boundaries. Part of those urban growth boundaries, now we're seeing the after effect of that, which means that you have to stay within that boundary area. And what happens is areas like Yaha, it's even Florence, the cost of housing is very limited, so it continues to go up. So the richer buy out the rich, the richest buy out the richer, and then you have situations like Sedona, Arizona, or Vail, Colorado. And it's basically the entire state of Oregon is becoming like that. So we have to revisit the urban growth boundary issue. That's number one. Number two is we have a situation where counties and cities relied heavily on the revenues from our forests. In fact, our rural counties, almost a third to two-thirds of their income came from the revenues from forests. When that was cut back, it wasn't like those cities and counties were asked to provide less services. They were required to pay the same amount of services with less money. So they had to be creative. And one of the ways they became very creative was setting up fees and assessments, and it particularly went on new development. So when I talk to developers that are looking at building housing, one of the things they talk about is that the amount of fees and assessments are to the point that it's very difficult for them to build a home that would be considered workforce housing or affordable housing. You know, these folks along the coast here, you know, down in Coos County, the average income is $33,000 a year. You move further up the coast, up into Florence, it's $37,000 a year. That's going to buy you a house of $150,000 or less.
And there's not a lot of those to
be found. There is not a lot of those.
Well, I think I, I know a little bit about what you're speaking. There was a 10-acre parcel just south of the bridge on Highway 101 that I had looked at a couple of years ago. And I started doing some research on it and found out that, well, first the county needed this amount of money. I think it was $10,000 or something like that to do a study to see if it could even be built upon. And then there was no guarantee that they would come back with a favorable response for you to build on it. And then there were fees and things tacked on upon that. I guess that's sort of some of the things you're talking about, because they need money to finance, you know, services that they're providing, mm-hmm. and that's one of the ways they do it.
It is. And you can't blame them, because there's that quality of life piece. And again, it goes clear back to a major source of revenue that was taken away. And so that's one reason why there's a big push for healthy forest initiatives and making sure that we take a serious look at that instead of letting one of our biggest resources just burn.
So what can a state representative do then to solicit the federal government to open some of these lands for harvesting?
Well, it's important to understand that there are state lands also, and even some of our counties have lands, and they're allowed to harvest a certain portion of it. But what has happened is the restrictions on harvesting have been so great. So you're looking at different types of land, and you want to be able to open up that access. In addition to that, the question regarding who's the best steward of the land, I understand that we have federal entities that are managing specific land. I recently took a trip to Crater Lake, and during that time, of course, everything was on fire. I could clearly see the difference between land management as I moved from one entity to another. And then when I got into the national park, it was a thicket.
It's almost like non-existent.
It was no non-existent. Management. And so I would argue that the best management will always come local with local folks, and we really need to get back to that, or we're just going to burn our resource.
Yeah, I could see that, sure. Now, some of the other things that are going on right now, healthcare is obviously still a big button for everybody. Not much has changed. The Congress, the federal government, has not really done a whole lot, not made any headway in kind of working with that. What kind of things is the state doing, or what is the state in trouble? Is there, you know, a good outlook for the state down the road? How are we looking with the healthcare?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that are really important to understand. You have healthcare in general, but rural healthcare is a unique animal in and of itself, because you have the issue of being able to attract folks to be able to provide that care. And it's not just doctors at the top level. People are retiring to our coast because it's an amazing place to live. It's got, you know, it's not extreme weather. But with that comes the responsibility of being able to care for those people. And that includes everything from home health aides, CNAs. And so you see that all along the coast. And, you know, recently down the coast in this district, we received word that a major facility for assisted living was closing or is closing. That's going to provide a huge impact all along this area in the Central Coast, because not only do you have to find a place for those elderly people to live, which is a very sensitive community, but you're also dealing with the fact that that was the one place where people could go to do rehab care if they fell and broke a hip or a knee or something like that. And so now we'll have to move our rehab folks out of the rural area. So you're looking at not only being able to attract professionals, but you're also looking at being able to provide care for the people who have chosen to live here. And those are huge issues. I will tell you that this issue is near and dear to my heart, because I grew up in a rural area very similar to this. At one point in time, as rural healthcare started, you know, I grew up in a mining community. And so you had the mining hospital, the mining clinic, you know, it definitely, they had a major impact on the community. When the mines closed or when lumber closed in our area, a lot of those facilities closed. And then facilities that were run by the counties, they had to close because they were no longer receiving the tax revenues in order to provide.
From those industries.
Right. And so folks had to become very creative. I actually served on a task force appointed by the speaker and spent about 6 months traveling the state, talking to healthcare professionals, talking to folks in rural communities, trying to come up with some problems solving mechanisms. It turned into three pieces of legislation that were the first on the governor's desk and the first to sign. Mind you, this is in a different state. But some of this problem-solving issues were the fact that we had state colleges that it's subsidized by state revenues, and we had students attending those colleges, but they weren't necessarily reinvesting into rural parts of the state. As we went around and spoke to physicians, physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, and other healthcare professionals, they had trained in other states at state colleges, and one of the things that they mentioned was the fact that their programs all had a rural rotation. And excuse me. So they planned on going to the big city and making lots of money in the big city. But while they were going to school, they did their rural rotation and they fell in love with the people and the culture.
And then stayed.
And they sought that out and they stayed. So that's one piece that I think is really important. I think.
So it's something you'd like to see happen here
in
Oregon.
I would. In addition, right now, our rural areas are almost held hostage by a single-payer system and having them come in, you know, begging them to come in and provide services. I'd like to see our rural communities be empowered to set up rural healthcare districts, and whether that mean funding a clinic, whether it mean funding to be able to bring doctors in, whether it mean providing funding so elderly folks can stay in their homes and it provides services so they don't have to leave the area. How that healthcare district is set up is based on the individual communities and where they feel the biggest need is. And that's empowering the people locally instead of begging, trying to recruit folks here. I think the third area that's really important is addressing, and I know that we have national grant forgiveness programs if doctors go to rural areas, but it's for a very short period of time. And I think we need to invest in those folks that we're asking to invest in us. And I think that's important.
We're speaking with Terry Greer. She is running for a state house in the 9th District, and we'll be back in just a moment.